because you know you've got 15 minutes, would you care to reserve any time for...
5 minutes, Your Honor.
Yes, sir. You may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I'm Lawrence Steele. I represent the appellant Charles Petillo. This issue involves the interpretation of the manifest injustice exception to the bar of spousal support under 20-107.1, and really two issues, whether the facts are sufficient to constitute the level of that exception, and secondly, I'm asking this court straight out to review the Barnes decision and to say it's wrong. Barnes basically said fault is not fault.
Well, it's, Mr. Deal, you know we may be a pass-through to somewhere else, but you know we can't.
Well, I'm not sure.
Unless you know, we distinguish Barnes, how, you know, we're... The interpanel accord doctrine.
I'm going to put it on the record as my argument. If you feel you can't change stare decisis because of that principle, which I understand that. I'm going to read from the David case, which was the most recent case where for 25 years this court had interpreted increase of value issues in a certain way, and the Supreme Court said, no, the language is clear. And it says, courts must not construe the plain language of a statute in a way that adds a requirement that the General Assembly did not expressly include in the statute. Any problems in that cannot be remedied by judicial construction by opposing a requirement that effectively would add new language to the statute. Well, when it says the respective degrees of fault, what they've in substance done is to say it's the respective degrees of conduct that's almost blameless. But we have to still look at it. Where did they get that? If you look at Barnes, nothing. No cites, no history. And if you look at the history here, I would invite the court to look at Reed and Sprott, which are pre-Barnes cases, pre-adultery bar cases, but still, in the context of the bar for the fault grounds at that time, interpreted the fault to mean grounds of divorce. A gradual breakdown is not grounds sufficient to have barred it under the old rule. Why would the interpretation of fault be any different now? This court found a gradual breakdown. Clearly, by its own findings, that does not constitute that conduct that would establish it as fault. I would argue that the context of other statutes also support that reconsideration. Since the Barnes decision, we've had other statutes, and this is a new way to look at it because we didn't have what I'm going to argue at the time Barnes came out. First, under 2107.3E5, that's a factor that says the court in doing equitable distribution can consider the grounds of divorce or the circumstances of the dissolution, maybe blameless. That's an additional specific term in addition to fault. 2 years ago, the General Assembly added a factor under 2107.1E, I think it's 13, that says the court can consider fault or the circumstances of the dissolution in deciding the amount of support. Hasn't been applied in any appellate decisions yet because it's fairly new. Why would they use that extra language when they had the opportunity to have just said fault? And then we have the predicate under 107.1 that says in deciding whether to award support, the court can consider the grounds of divorce or. Every single place where there's been the reference to fault as a factor or a bar, there's been other language. It's not in this statute. And now that we have new legislation where we assume the General Assembly understands what it passed by adding other language, requires a reconsideration of what they looked at because they didn't have those directives of the General Assembly on that. It says that when the General Assembly has used specific language, I'm citing from David case, citing Zanone, which is in my brief. When the General Assembly has used specific language in one instance but omits that language or uses different language when addressing a similar subject elsewhere in the code, we must presume that the difference in the choice of language was intentional. Barnes never addressed whether that was applicable. This court should. The plain language is clear. And the policy is just absurd that this guy has to pay for support when his wife clearly committed blatant adultery in parking lots of a Home Depot for two gentlemen over 3 or 4 years, said to all her friends, I don't want to be married. And yet the same conduct and quality of acts that in Reed, inattentiveness, he's always working late, The same conduct that was reversed in Giraldi, which Judge Attlee, you joined in on, where there was...
Giraldi was different than this, wasn't it?
Yes, there was no findings.
That was reversed because there wasn't an analysis under manifest injustice.
That's correct, but you did say, even though the court doesn't have to make those findings, we're going to look at it. And so, by implication, you all did look at it to decide to reverse it. But yes, there was no findings on that. I understand that. But the quality of the facts in there was the same thing. He'd come home, he'd go upstairs, the allegation on that. But in Reed and Sprott, those were not at the level of the quality of acts that would cause grounds of divorce for cruelty. And therefore, the wife's unhappiness. In fact, what the court said in Reed was, I think, instructive. It said, rather, the evidence established the pattern of conduct, indeed the entire marital relationship, established by both parties, resulting in her frustration and guided her decision to terminate the marriage. Mrs. Reed's complaints that Dr. Reed absented himself from the home and his proper share of the child discipline while working to provide financially for her and the family cannot serve as a justification for leaving him. Mrs. Reed would have us draw a fine line between where perhaps one excelled in one duty to the family at the sacrifice of another duty. That we cannot do. This court has tried to do that. Her testimony cannot rise higher than her evidence cannot rise higher than her testimony under Massey versus Firmstone. So let's look at the record and now get to whether the facts, under assuming Barnes is the law, justified the findings.
Don't we have to give deference on factual findings to the...
That's the Street case, but you also have to also look at the fact that Massey versus Firmstone, her own testimony that is a factual finding, can't rise higher. So what did she say in terms of what was his good qualities? He's a hard worker. Just like in Reed, that didn't raise to the level of conduct. And I'm arguing that that's not clear and convincing evidence. She clearly had the facts. It's an abuse of discretion for this court to conclude that those facts justified her in having adultery. It's almost like saying, if I'm not happy because he works hard and I think that's a good quality, I can leave him and I can go around and have adultery and intercourse with two other men. What a message for the public. Now, the other thing that she said was, I was provided for. She complained about his maybe control of the money. So what? He gave her what she wanted. She wanted a house. She got a car. She got a boat. She even said, you know, we had a good life and a good lifestyle. So how is there a nexus between her complaint? It's a pretext for what happened here. And I don't think a fact finder can get around that under Street as far as what the record is. This is her own testimony, Massey versus Firmstone. Her testimony can't rise higher. There was no corroboration. If we are dealing with fault as a grounds under the statute, nothing was corroborated, just her own testimony. Everybody else that came in said she never complained about the money. She never complained about really anything. She admitted there was no abuse physically.
But Barnes doesn't say fault grounds, does it, for that? That's not what Barnes holds. That fault isn't used as legal fault.
It said that, correct. And I'm saying that's wrong. I'm saying that should be reviewed in the context of now other statutes.
But once again, you know this panel cannot do that, even if we were so inclined.
Why?
Because of the inter-panel accord doctrine. But typically, I ask you the questions instead of vice versa.
I apologize, Your Honor. My question is, my response would be, in the David case, the opportunity was there to clarify it, and it was not. And maybe Judge Decker's comment is correct. It might be another court for another day. But there are new factors that have come in for a review. And those factors I'm suggesting are the new statutes that intentionally looked at fault and other circumstances which this court interpreted before that was there. So yes, Barnes says it doesn't have to be grounds of a divorce. But it also has said it can be blameless. Now how can the word fault, under any interpretation of cases that I've cited, under the dictionary definition of fault, be blameless or relatively blameless? How did these facts justify, even under that standard, how he would still have to pay support based on her complaints, which are, again, almost on all fours of Sprott and Reed, communication issues, worked too hard, didn't spend time with the kids, they did go through counseling, and Mr. Bowden is going to probably talk about, well, he admitted that it was a problem. He admitted that this was something that led to their problems. What he admitted to was conduct, but not conduct that created the grounds of a divorce or a level of conduct that was sufficient under the statute. So taking the evidence at the court's findings, which he's entitled to do under Street, I acknowledge that, I'm arguing that he should still not have had to pay support, that it's error to say this is clear and convincing evidence. And again, I think it's an insult that he has to pay support under the blatant conduct of the wife in this case, where the court says, I find that her adultery did cause the demise of this case. And the fact that my argument about Barnes, it's a little disingenuous to say I wasn't aware that Barnes has been around for 25 years or something implying that. Certainly it's in my treatise. I've always known Barnes. But this first chance I've had to argue the issue that I don't think it's proper and was wrong, and I understand stare decisis, but there are changing factors that I'm asking the court to review in the terms of what the General Assembly had said. We're going to use fault and other grounds. Wasn't done here. Look at it. Think about it. And I would ask you to reverse it.
Mr. Deal, you may or may not know the answer to this, but was Barnes appealed to the Supreme Court?
I don't know.
Okay. I don't either.
Well, it wasn't accepted if it was a writ to do it.
Right.
So I can't answer that. I don't know.
Okay.
I think it was judges that aren't on the court anymore. They're all retired now. Thank you. I'll reserve the rest.
May it please the court. My name is Alan Bowden. I'm privileged to be here before you on behalf of my client, Allison Patillo. I had a lot of prepared remarks to say. Looks like that may be going out the window as I attempt to try to answer some of Mr. Deal's comments. I think what's important in this case is that Mr. Deal's client, Mr. Patillo, is asking this panel to step into the shoes of Judge Regal in the trial court. Judge Regal listened to over 8 hours of testimony. He listened to the parties testify for hours. He listened to 6 material other witnesses. He reviewed 27 exhibits and 4 trial aides. We came back on 2 motions for reconsideration, 2 motions to reopen the evidence. And Judge Regal, in my opinion, wrote a very well thought out, reasoned letter opinion, which laid out the reasons for which he found that under Barnes and its progeny, that this lady deserves support under the manifest injustice statute, or the finding in Barnes of 107.
The exception.
Yes, ma'am. And so I would submit to the panel that the trial court in this case had ample evidence to support its findings. And I'm going to just take a minute because of Mr. Deal's allegations here today that there were no factual underpinnings. I'd like to just take a few moments, if you don't mind, and point out some of the things that were in the record. And if you'll excuse me, I'm going to go ahead and give you the page number for the appendix in case you wanted to see that. The appellant instructed my client, Ms. Patillo, to keep track of every expense, every penny, from a bagel to a postage stamp. That's $6.68. He would never spend time with the children. That's Appendix 653. He refused to take any time off from work, even when the doctor told him and his wife that he needed to stay home after she lost their third child, and told him and her that she could not lift their 10-month-old son, Callum. He said, no, I'm not taking any time off. That's Appendix at 670. She asked him to engage in counseling to save their marriage before any allegation of adultery. Mr. Patillo refused. That's 674 and 677. His routine was to come home from work, grab a couple of drinks, go to his computer, and then go to bed. It wasn't just Mrs. Patillo that testified to that. It was Mr. Patillo as well. This marriage was lost 10 years prior to the divorce. This marriage was lost well before Ms. Patillo decided to have extramarital affairs, which we all know is wrong. But marriages fail for a multitude of reasons. And in this case, this marriage failed because these two people could not get along, were basically roommates. She was a single mom at home while he worked. The testimony is he left at 3:30 in the morning, didn't get home until 6 at night, went to his computer. He took Valium and Tramadol and drank cocktails until he went to bed every night. This was not a marriage. This was a partnership and a friendship at best. 556 for the Tramadol and Valium on top of daily cocktails. He admitted he took his wife out under oath less than 5 times in 10 years. He could not deny that he gave her $100 a month for her to spend while giving the church $1,200 against her objection. Now, I'm not against giving the church $1,200 a month. Don't get me wrong. But when you're never taking your wife out and you limit her to $100 a month, when you make well over $250,000 a year, I think the court can see where she would get frustrated with this over the years. He would make crass remarks about her private parts after she had their children. I'm not going to get into the remarks, but you can look at them yourself in the record. It's 676. I don't think any woman would appreciate the sorts of remarks that Mr. Petillo made to his wife. They're awful. He would not only call his wife fat, but he would encourage their children to call her fat mommy. She testified under oath that this deeply wounded her. This was well before she decided to have affairs. He surreptitiously tracked her on her car through OnStar, 162. He admitted that he made the money in the family and that he made all of the financial decisions. When I pressed him on this, he said, yes, I make the money, I make the decisions. All of the decisions, over her objections, investments, everything. He acknowledged that he was, in fact, partially to blame for the failure of the marriage. That's 601 and 679. He even sent her a letter stating that he was, quote, truly sorry for his actions and words, or lack of actions and words, that led them to this point in their marriage. That's 1,223, if you care to look at that email. He admitted that their marriage was not a healthy one. That's Appendix 604. Mr. Petillo earned over $260,000 per year. Mrs. Petillo received $269,000 of the marital assets, which were roughly $610,000. That was through a settlement, and a large part of that was because of her adultery. She didn't want to go through this. She didn't want to put her children through a trial, and so she settled, hoping that the whole thing would settle. And it didn't. Now, through trial, motions for reconsideration, 2 pendente lite hearings, and now this, she has completely run out of all the money that she had except for a little over $150,000 in retirement funds, which she can't touch unless she takes a loan against it. She makes $9 an hour. You can look at Appendix 708-45. At the time of trial, Ms. Petillo had spent all of the liquid assets she was given under the marital agreement. Her earning capacity, as testified to by Mr. Tony Byrd, could have been up to $23,000 a year if she got her computer training. She has a general diploma from the UK. Mr. Petillo was earning $260,000 a year. Mr. Petillo, through this petition, is asking this court to stand in the shoes of the trial court and substitute your judgment for that of Judge Regal.
Counsel, can I ask you a question?
Yes, ma'am.
What is your response to Mr. Deal's point about subsequent statutory changes post-Barnes?
Well, I would say that with regard to his statutory construction argument, I did look into his point. Once I got his brief about the use of the term fault in the statute, I will tell you that I researched, did the search in Title 20. There's 2 references to fault. One is in the statute that we're talking about today, and the other is in 20-109B, where it basically says an event which the court anticipated which would occur during the duration of the award, and which was significant in the making of the award, does not in fact occur through no fault of the party. So there's no definitional concept to the word fault. So when Mr. Deal argues that this court and all judges and all case law knows what fault is and it's what's in the statutes, it's simply not true. The term fault only appears twice, and really the only substantive time is in this very statute that we're talking about today. So in my opinion, respectfully, Barnes did exactly what the what judges are supposed to do. They try to figure out what the General Assembly means. They apply it to the facts. They give their opinion, and then you all get to decide whether they got it right or wrong. Now, I will say that we're all aware that the General Assembly is presumed to understand and know the interpretation of its statutes. And this statute, day after tomorrow, will be exactly 25 years old. I'm sorry, Barnes. Barnes, day after tomorrow, will be exactly 25 years old. The General Assembly has had ample time and numerous cases in front of you all to be able to correct that definition and say, you know what, you guys, it's going a little too far. What we meant was you have to prove fault. It's simply not the law currently in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And I just don't think that, you know.
They haven't done that, have they?
No, ma'am. They haven't.
So we're to presume that they have acquiesced or agreed with this court's
interpretation. I agree, Your Honor. And I believe that Judge Mims and his concurrence in, I'm sorry, Your Honor, his concurrence in American Tradition Institution and versus Rector and Visitors of the University of Virginia, 287 Virginia 330, in his concurrence he says, under one canon, we presume that the General Assembly is aware of how we construe the terms it used in a statute and that it acquiesces in such constructions unless it subsequently enacts a corrective amendment. Again, I would posit to the court that we've had ample time. This is not, you know, in all honesty, I wouldn't quibble as much with Mr. Deal's argument if this case were a July 2016 case, and you guys would be hearing this for the first time. But Barnes has been around for 25 years as of day after tomorrow. One thing I wanted to get out before my time runs out is this issue of attorney's fees. As stated in Mundy versus Mundy, this court is the proper forum to determine the propriety of an award of attorney's fees for the efforts expended on the appeal. And that's Mundy at 184, citing Bechara versus Bechara. As I already stated to you all, but I'd like to do it one more time, is Ms. Patilla doesn't have any money. She had very little after the divorce. 2 PL motions, 2 motions for reconsideration, 2 motions to reopen the evidence, a very, very well-written, in my opinion, letter opinion by Judge Regal, who I thought was incredibly thoughtful throughout the trial. I just feel like this case warrants an award of attorney's fees for Mrs. Patilla, and I would just leave you with the thought that I just don't see, given the record, how you could find that Judge Regal abused his discretion. And I really appreciate your time and appreciate being here.
Thank you. Mr. Deal?
On the issue of fees, I actually, as you may know, drafted the new rule that expands our consideration of factors. We're not frivolous in this case. I think we have legitimate issues, whether it's the facts under the current scope or my argument about the propriety of the Barnes decision. I would ask the court to not grant it. And generally, it's pretty unusual that they are granted unless there really is a frivolous argument. And I wouldn't be here if I didn't think there was some merit to this. Not that I'm here, but just the facts of what we have presented. I've been doing General Assembly stuff for 28 years. I've been up there every year. It's never come up either way. It'd be speculative to know what the General Assembly thinks, and by their silence, you can't imply.
The law says we can. The law says we must.
Well, I can just tell you it's never come up either way. So I can't change the law. I got that. Maybe we need to change the statute.
We can't either.
So I understand that. Let me talk, though, about he's going through a lot of these litany of facts. This is a 10-year period, and this is why gradual breakdowns are not grounds for divorce because, or even justification for leaving. If it was that bad and she had all these problems, she would have left years earlier. I don't see a nexus between those acts, where she says there was no cruelty, no arguments, we didn't communicate much, and her going out and blatantly sending nude photos, committing adultery. The policy behind this statute is to not reward adultery. That's the policy behind this statute. If these facts come under the conduct of fault, then you've basically rendered this statute meaningless, because every case in divorces is going to have some communication issues. That's why they're going through a divorce. Every case has some arguments, whether it's children or finances or something. And you would basically convert what are everyday arguments between parties that lead to divorces to I can't think of a divorce that wouldn't be under the exception that this Barnes case has said, or that the facts of this case say. Again, she was pretty blatant about her conduct. She was secretive. She lied about it. And I don't think that justifies it. If this court says it's okay to do all this adultery based on these facts, then you've sent a signal out to the public that go ahead and mess around. It doesn't matter. And I think I'm not trying to be flippant here, but that's the effect of what this would do. There are definitions of fault in other statutes and cases. I've cited cases where they've used the word fault. I don't know what he looked up to find this or that, but there's cases where fault meant grants a divorce. And so I would disagree that there's little definitional helps on that. So I would argue that the court abuses discretion on these facts in continuing the award. And yes, we can use... Well, let me just finish up by saying this. I'm reading from a case that actually came out yesterday. It was unpublished that I won, but it just says a principle. Bearing in mind, however, an appellate court should not simply rubber stamp every discretionary decision of a trial court. To the contrary, we have an obligation to review the record, upon doing so to reverse the judgment of the trial court if we find a clear abuse of discretion. Although the decision to award spousal support rests within the trial court's discretion, such discretion is not absolute and is subject to review for abuse. If this case is an abusive, we'll never have one. I ask that it be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Consistent with the tradition of the court, we'll come down and greet.